welcome to a special profanity-free edition of the QTR podcast. How about that? I actually had just recorded this entire intro, and Montana Skeptic texted me, and he said, let's try to keep this one profanity-free. So I said, all right, out of respect for you, because you're my guest, and because I've been annoying you to come on for the last, you know, month or two, and now you finally decided to get back to me and come on, which I'm very appreciative of, I will keep it profanity-free to the extent that I know how, but that means maybe the next podcast I do, I'm going to have to come out of the gate like a stuttering person with Tourette's syndrome. It's going to be very, very bad next time. So you can have the kids around for this podcast, but you may want to steer them clear of everything else I've ever done, especially the next one. Today's edition of the QTR podcast, today's April 28th for those keeping score at home, today's edition of the podcast is brought to you by my friends over at JM Bullion. JM Bullion is my new favorite place to order gold and silver. Am I just saying that because they are patrons of the podcast? No. You want to know how? You could go back through the emails I just had with JM Bullion last week when they decided to sign up and become patrons. And I said, I'm going to shout you guys out, but only if your service isn't terrible. So I ordered some stuff from them in April. It shipped the same day. I got it. It is high quality stuff. I like the guys over at JM Bullion. So far, they have not messed up at all as my new, probably exclusive bullion dealers. They seem to have better stock than other people that I order from, and they seem like very nice people too. So I've worked out an arrangement for QTR podcast listeners only. JM Bullion, if you go on their site and you want to make a purchase of bullion, use code QTR5 at the checkout. There's a little gift card area. Punch in QTR5, you're going to get $5 off your offer, and you're going to get free shipping. Thanks so much to my friends at JM Bullion for continuing to support me. I hope you guys support them and the other guys that support this podcast, like my friend Sang Lucci, who was on yesterday. Sang Lucci, I asked him yesterday, what do you sell? He says, we sell very specific types of data. And the Sang Lucci Steam Room is one of a kind. There's nothing like it. While most people right now are tracking unusual options action, he noted yesterday that what they do is very different. They're just looking for aggressive money coming into the options market, no matter where it is. If it's usual, unusual, if it's repeat sweeps, not just, you know, tracking one big order here or there that comes in. Look, Lucci has been tracking money in the illiquid options market for almost a decade. There's nobody that does it better than his service. I know him personally. He's an honest person. I endorse him as a person to do business with. At least to the best of my knowledge of him, he seems like a great human being from what I've gathered over the last 10 years. We have hung out in person. I can consider him a friend. The Sang Lucci Steam Room is one of a kind, and they have a free trial too. Go to sanglucci.com to check it out. Both JM Bullion and Sang Lucci links are in my podcast description. This podcast is also brought to you by my dear friend Pete Hegedus over at The Trader's Path. If you're looking for a new investment or day trading community to become a part of, check out my brother Pete over at The Trader's Path. Pete started The Trader's Path when he got tired of other day trading communities because he felt like he was being lied to. He felt like his trades were being front run. I don't know if he can prove it, but he just felt like the people running them didn't have his best interest in mind. And if you're familiar with the financial industry, that shouldn't surprise you at all. So Pete said, I'm going to start my own service, and it's called The Trader's Path, which I am happy to endorse on this podcast. The Trader's Path offers daily watch lists. They offer live streams on the daily. They offer investor education. They traded red markets, green markets, options, stocks. Reach out to Pete if it's something you're interested in. You can use the link in my podcast description, or you can follow him on Twitter at PLHStock. That's also in the podcast description. But any of these guys, if you want to check them out, just shoot them a note, tell them QTR sent you, and you want to make a deal with them. They're going to hook you up. Also, check out my friends over at RumorHound. RumorHound is another piece of software. There's nothing like it out there. It uses a proprietary algorithm and looks at variables, feeds them into an artificial intelligence system that it has to try to distinguish which merger and acquisition rumors that we hear about on the daily, and if you're a day trader, you know they happen daily, which rumors are worth paying attention to and which ones may be worth ignoring. As a trader, obviously you know that that's lucrative information or can be lucrative information. So all of these services, similar to RumorHound, I mean, they can pay for themselves if you are good at managing your own risk and you use them as part of a, you know, strategy that incorporates a lot of other tools as a day trader. they could wind up paying for themselves. So check out my dear friends over at Rumorhound. They've been supporting the podcast for a long time. I love their software. It is it's really aesthetically a very pleasing piece of software to look at. It functions well, and you can follow them at Rumorhound on Twitter if you want some free rumor and free merger and acquisition rumors as they happen too. And it doesn't cost anything to follow the Twitter account. They will also offer you a 14-day free trial. I also want to thank Corvus Gold, my friend Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground, Chris Boas, Ken R., Chris Bede, Nicholas Parks, Matthew Zimmer, my homeboy Jay Mintzmyer, Russ Valenti, Creighton Titus, and M3. What's going on, brother? Haven't shouted you out in a while. Two rules for this podcast. There's a 2-drink minimum, and I'm not a financial advisor. Neither is my guest. We don't advocate for you doing anything that we talk about. We hold no licenses, no registrations, and we are only talking about our own opinions. Do your research elsewhere. All right, on the line with me today, and armed with a glass of wine, he admits to me at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which is actually quite impressive for a guy that politely asked me not to use any profanity on the podcast today. I guess getting drunk is better than cursing in his world. I have the well-known Tesla skeptic and buddy of mine, Montana Skeptic. How are you today, sir?
Hey, Chris. I'm not quite drunk yet, but I'm great. Thank you.
Well, you got to have goals, you know?
Right.
Something to look forward to for the rest of the night.
All right. I'll aspire to that.
What kind of wine are you drinking?
I'm drinking a humble Nebbiolo, a grape from the beautiful Piedmont region of Italy. In its more luscious incarnations, it is called a Barbaresco or a Barolo. But it's a terrific grape, maybe the best in Italy.
I don't even know if that's a red or a white grape.
So it's red, yeah.
Is it? Okay, what's it closest to?
I would drink a if there were no red wine left in the world, I might drink white wine. What's it closest to? It's more astringent and less sweet than like a Cabernet. Okay. So I don't know what I would compare. You know,
is it dry like a Cabernet?
It's drier than a Cabernet. Yeah,
a lot of tannin.
Yeah, lots of tannin. Yeah, and a beautiful, luscious wine. I mean, it's a. You should go someday splurge on a bottle of Barolo that's, say, 5 or 6 years old, and let it open up, and you'll see the magic of it. But here, we're not going to talk about wine.
Well, what if I want to talk about wine? We can just
all right. Well, we can do that.
Who's directing the proceedings here? You know,
in Italy, what they do is the government regulates the wine, and so it says in a particular region, if you grow this grape in this region, we will let you call it this. And for the Nebbiolo grape is grown in a wide area, and you can call your wine a Nebbiolo, and they'll put something called DOC on it, which means Denominazione di Origine Controllata. But if in that same region, in little tiny subregions with particular soil, or as the French say, terroir, you grow your wine. The Nebbiolo grape, and you produce it in a certain way that has been time-tested and passed down through the families, through the centuries, you can call it a Barolo, or you can call it a Barbaresco. And then you get a DOCG label, which is Denominazione di Origine Controllata e Garantita. So, in other words, we're guaranteeing you that this wine is from this region, and we control its production, and it's just as it's been produced in that time-tested, lovely, beautiful way that makes Italy so famous for its wine. So there you go.
Awesome. How about that? A little wine class to start things off. Well, listen, we couldn't have picked a better day to do a podcast. I mean, we had today set up well in advance, and we wake up this morning, and the first thing that I see is a tweet that says, Tesla's amended 10-K now states that the company will not be taking on D&O insurance. Instead, Elon Musk will be indemnifying his own board of directors, I guess, against any liabilities in the future that, you know, the same type of liabilities that D&O insurance would indemnify them against, which is just, I thought when I read it at first, was the most astounding thing I had ever seen. And then I was like, well, maybe this is more common than I think, because I couldn't remember anybody ever doing it. Then I saw Jim Chanos tweet, in 40 years, I've never seen anything like this. So I'd love to open the conversation by getting your thoughts on what the hell heck is going on. Sorry.
Yeah. It was pretty stunning, I thought. And, you know, I don't know if Chanos, I'm sure he's right that he's never seen it before. Has it ever happened before? Not to my knowledge. Okay, maybe in small companies.
Right.
If you try to attract in a privately held company and you're the rich founder and you want some, you know, impecunious scientist to sit on your board, you would promise to indemnify him if there were any claims. Maybe that's more common. But I've never heard of it. So, number one. Number two, you'll remember that in the Delaware Chancery Court suit, which is the most imminent, you know, liability of materiality that Tesla or Musk faces, it goes to trial in July, I think on July 27 through August 7 is what the court has announced, assuming there are no further delays. There, the directors who were defendants originally settled, and so they left in the case only Tesla and Elon Musk as defendants. And Tesla is actually a nominal defendant. It's a curious thing that if Musk gets tagged, he would be paying the money to Tesla. As someone noted today, it could be the first time, you know, that Tesla is really actually materially profitable if Musk is forced to sell some stock and pay it to the shareholders, pay it to the company. So the questions in my mind are this. It appears that the existing policy is expired. Okay. Now, if Musk gets tagged, that would that, you know, there's a difference in these D&O policies and in all insurance policies between a claims made and a occurrence policy. But I think now Tesla is utterly uninsured for anything. Okay. It could pay up and have its claims made policy coverage continued, or it could choose not to, which evidently is what it chose to do. So I think any liability, even if the coverage limits weren't exhausted before in the earlier policy, any liability going forward is all on Musk. And what does that mean? That means that there's a real share price dynamic at work here. If Tesla gets tagged, if the directors get tagged, you know, for example, the directors, I think, are being sued in the class action in California. And I know they're being sued for failure, you know, for control liability, for failing to control the actions of the management that they were supposed to be watching over. If there's director liability there, for example, Musk would have to sell stock. It would create a big danger to the company itself. It would create the risk that Musk might be unable to perform. I mean, it's wild, right? On the other hand, there's a really interesting kind of contrarian thinker, brilliant guy, Matt Levine, who used to be at Goldman Sachs, who writes like a column periodically for Bloomberg. And today he was out with another piece and he said, you know, maybe this is a good idea. What this does is it aligns Musk's incentives better, because Musk now knows if he misbehaves like he's so prone to do, it could come directly out of his hide instead of being covered by insurance. And I don't buy it for a lot of reasons, but there's that, right? So, and I don't buy it because, you know, it's just crazy not to have continued the coverage they had in effect, number one. And number two, to think Musk is about to change his behavior.
He's never thought about, obviously, the consequences of his actions to this point forward. So I don't think that – I think he probably views himself as, I've got – you know, my worth is X amount, even if it's in semi-illiquid stock maybe, or is pledged for loans. But my worth is X and that can't be touched. And, you know, I've kind of gotten over maybe the worst. But aren't there legal issues? Aren't there legacy issues that this could come around to bite the directors with? I mean, I'm talking about stuff that's outstanding now and – things that have happened in the past that could still be causes of action.
Well, you know, sure, the directors face liability. I think the big, you know, in fairness, the biggest liability that they had to be worried about was that SolarCity suit, and they settled it. Okay, so now it's just all Musk. But yeah, they, of course, they always face liability. And the claims that could be made, for example, that are being made in the class action that's been consolidated now. You have a lead plaintiff in California and Judge Edward Chen's United States District Court. And he just issued an opinion a few weeks ago denying the motion to dismiss the claim as failing to state a claim that the defendants had filed. And he thumped them pretty thoroughly, saying, look, this funding secured. There's no way it was aspirational. It was Musk really said these things. Tesla really adopted these things. And it looks like the directors, they've alleged that adequately that the directors were asleep at the switch. And if that case went to trial, if it settles, they'll find some way to put who's going to pay the liability? How do you allocate it among Musk and the directors? That'll be interesting now, won't it? You've got Musk, who's their insurer, so I guess he could say, well, it's all mine anyway. But still, that could be a serious liability. Unfortunately, that one's fortunately or unfortunately, it's down the road, probably a year and a half or 2 years before that ever gets to trial, because now you go through discovery and all the fights you have there. There are FSD lawsuits out there. Hey, you sold me this product, full self-driving, and you knew it didn't exist, and you sold me something that you promised it that while I had this car, it would come, and it hasn't come. My lease is up, or my car's 5 years old, or 3 years old, or whatever, and so it's worth less than what I paid for it. It's possible that some of those implicate the directors for failing to supervise Musk. Robo-taxi claims, et cetera. The directors have done absolutely nothing that's visible to me anyway to in any way restrain, discipline, rein in, supervise Elon Musk ever. We had the Twitter sitter for a while. It's clear there is no Twitter sitter. Musk is all but daring the SEC to do something about it, and the board hasn't lifted a finger. And now you have a new board member who just signed on. His greatest qualification seems to be that, A, he may have access to Japanese money, which would be good, I understand. And B, he said ugly things about short selling. So that's always a commendation in Elon Musk's book, right?
Yeah, I tweeted out when that happened, because his past is in dealing with Japanese pension funds, $1.5 trillion Japanese pension fund, BOJ money. I said how great he's going from one scheme to another. He should fit right in, from the BOJ scheme. Do you think that what are your thoughts about why they decided to not take on coverage? I know that you're not a mind reader, and I know we're just guessing, and I know we're just batting it around, but I was thinking this morning, is it more of an issue of maybe the premiums were just too astronomical, or could it be like they really don't have the cash to do it? I mean, those are kind of the same problem, but I mean, what's your initial reaction?
Well, I think there are, with my limited imagination, there are two possibilities that come to mind. The first is that the quotes they got were so supremely expensive that they realized they couldn't spend the cash on that. It was just too high. And the second is that the D&O market finally woke up and said, wait a minute, you got a monkey with a machine gun running your company. You're not doing anything to restrain him. And we are not writing coverage under any circumstances, because we have shareholders who will sue us for, irresponsible underwriting. Those are the two possibilities.
And it seems like if something terrible were to happen that would necessitate this type of insurance – just say, for example, the Department of Justice came in and shut the company down next week, right? It's not going to happen, but let's say that something like that occurred. Musk's entire net worth is contingent upon Tesla's stock price. So if the stock price gets ahead of them being able to file a claim for D&O insurance, which it almost assuredly will, the market will know first before the time it takes for them to process a claim, there may not ultimately be anybody to pay a claim to begin with, right?
Well, that question kind of brings up an important point that I haven't thought enough about, and that is this. D&O insurance does not cover everything, and it does not cover people acting fraudulently. And I suspect that in the Delaware case, the D&O carrier wrote a letter to Musk saying, we reserve rights. We do not think we are liable to cover you, to indemnify you in this lawsuit. So we are going to, we'll provide a defense right now, and we're going to hire a separate counsel to be so-called coverage counsel, so that, because you're now on notice that we are challenging our duty to cover you. And I think that's what's happened in that Delaware case right now. So you know, if to the extent it's fraud, there is no coverage, theoretically, okay? Right. And if you can settle and resolve it all, you know, you can kind of work out a deal where the insurance company realizes it's at risk and the people who committed the bad deeds realize they're at risk and they come to some meeting of the minds about sharing the cost. But if it ever went to trial and there were determination, it were fraud, it's all on Musk anyway. He's in trouble. How the directors, who, you know, it seems to me in all these cases, the guy who committed the fraud is, if there's a determination of fraud, you know, J-Dart and all that, right, is Elon Musk, not the directors. The directors are simply grossly negligent. They are, as I wrote on Twitter, in an induced coma, but they're not the people committing the fraud. They're just the people letting it happen, right, willfully, you know. And does standing by knowing that the guy next to you is committing fraud and when you have a duty to supervise him, does that amount to fraud? I don't think so. I think it's something less than that. It's, you know, it's idiocy and it's negligence and it's gross negligence and it's recklessness, but I don't think it's fraud.
Let's talk about some of the work here that you've done over the last week or two. A couple of the articles that you've written have caught my eye for a couple of reasons. The first is that they deal with Tesla in China, and I am a vocal critic of China in the U.S. capital markets in any way due to their track record and due to my experience in working with U.S.-listed China-based companies. The second reason is because they seem to get an awful lot of attention over the last 2 weeks. I see your one article had like 1,000 comments on it, which is just astronomical. And Zero Hedge did a piece on one of them, and they were all over Twitter. And I was wondering if you could, for my listeners, talk about what it was that you laid out in these two articles about Tesla and China and some of the things that you explored, maybe why you think they got so much traction.
Yeah. Well, there were two articles. There was a first one last Friday, which is the one Zero Hedge picked up, and which also got on the Bloomberg terminal. And then, you know, people, as you said, there were 1,000+ comments. And so in the second one, we took some of the arguments made in the comments. The people who commented on the first one had said, there were a lot of idiotic comments as usual, but there were some really thoughtful ones, and said, wow, this is really bad, but can't Tesla do X, Y, Z, Q, or W and get out of this situation? And so we responded to those in the second one. Both of them are very detailed. Both of them are very data dense, I think. The first one got, you know, in most media circles, this is small potatoes. But for me at Seeking Alpha, I haven't had this happen before. It got 150,000 page views and climbing.
Wow.
So it got a lot of eyeballs, and
that's enormous for Seeking Alpha.
Yeah.
In the decade that I wrote for Seeking Alpha, or 5 years or whatever it was, I think the highest I ever got for an article was 60,000 or 70,000. That is enormous, 150,000 reads.
Yeah, it surprised me, and the reason is I think the analysts and the business press have completely ignored the implications of the agreements Tesla made in China. They probably have not even read them, most of the people out there. And they have missed the big story here. There are several big stories here, and they just missed it. One of the big stories is that Tesla Shanghai has, in effect, a different set of stakeholders from Tesla rest of the world. Tesla Shanghai is a separate subsidiary far down the chain, and it is the borrower under these loan agreements. And it has to, you know, it's going to borrow close to $1.5 billion plus from Chinese banks under the factory loan agreement and the working capital line that it's gotten. And it's going to take a long time to pay that back. The term of the factory loan is 5 years, which seems to me to be ambitious. And what the Chinese bank said, and completely understandably, is this: you may not take any money out of this company until we are fully repaid on all of our loans. All the money, all your revenues are to be deposited into control accounts, you know, that we have tight control over, and none of it leaves. And on top of that, you must, Tesla, rest of the world, contribute $700 million to our construction project. So this factory is ultimately going to, the two phases of the factory are going to add up to about $2 billion, and Tesla's got to put in about $700 million of that. So there will be money this year, last year and this year, moving from the United States to China. But for the next 5 years, there will be absolutely no money coming from China back. And that's a problem because even if the Tesla Shanghai operation were profitable, it wouldn't help the rest of the world, Tesla. And right now that Tesla Shanghai is taking customers away from Fremont. Fremont used to supply China. Well, all that's gone. And that brings us to the second point. Not only are they taking the Chinese demand away, you know, which will likely grow because they have the factory there, but it is, if you look at the structure of the agreement and you look at what was agreed to and you look at the goals of the communist, you know, Chinese Communist Party and the party officials and their five-year plan and what they have publicly said their goal is to become the leading manufacturer in the world with places like the United States reduced to supplying them, you know, raw materials and energy. That is absolutely, they've made that clear. And we quoted the, you know, that was made clear on a speech made during a state visit by Donald Trump and his cabinet members back in 2017. So, and you know, there's an H.R. McMaster article from The Atlantic that's out right now that I cited to, where he quotes a speech from the Chinese economic minister right along those lines. The way the agreement is written is that Tesla, by 2023, it's only, you know, 2 years from now, has got to be making basically $300,000 cars per year to satisfy the revenue requirement. And if it fails to do that, the Chinese can take the whole thing back, okay? But it only has to be making about 90,000 of those for domestic consumption in order to meet its VAT, value-added tax, goal for how much money China raises internally on sales domestically. So in other words, the Chinese contemplated Tesla would be selling 90,000 cars internally, but there'd be another 200,000 plus cars. Where do those go? Well, I think those are going to be exported. And when they're exported, that cuts further into the Fremont demand. You know, that Fremont used to supply Japan. It used to supply South Korea, Australia. I think you're going to see China do that. It's got to export those cars. And what my collaborator, who's a brilliant person named Maxed Out Mama, what my collaborator and I did is pull together, you know, demographic data, demand data, data about where the world markets are, and explained how there's no way in the world the Chinese domestic market can soak up that kind of production. It's going to have to be exported. And it's all made worse. This entire process of Tesla's center of gravity shifting to China is accelerated by the coronavirus crisis, which is just devastating for worldwide demand, and it's going to give the Chinese even more leverage over Tesla. So that was the first article to point all that stuff out. And we also, you know, in that article said, hey, it is time and well past time for Tesla, in view of these, the dynamic with China, to do what we call segment reporting, to break out China separately from right. the rest of its operations, so that, you know, investors have some idea of what's going on here. You know, Tesla could show a profit, and it could be starving to death in Fremont because the Chinese part might be profitable enough to repay some of the loan, for example, while Fremont is sucking wind and has to keep raising money. And there's no way to evaluate that without proper segment reporting, which was is required under, you know, generally accepted accounting principles, and we cited documents from the FASB.
Well, the opacity that it's operating with without that segmented reporting is what would hide exactly what you're talking about. I have just a couple questions. I want to unpack some of the things that you said. When you first started describing this, you said that 100% of the revenue that comes in is put into bank accounts to repay all of the Chinese loans first, and then just a second ago you alluded to profit. Is it top line, everything that they're taking in gets put into these escrow accounts essentially, or is it bottom line?
Well, okay. Everything goes, every nickel they collect goes into the control accounts, okay? And you use it first to repay interest accrued and outstanding, and then you retire principal. So the factory loan, which is the largest of them, has a five-year term, and it has an amortization schedule where, you know, in the first year you amortize 15%, and then it's I laid out the numbers in my articles, but you finally get to 60% of the principal paid down by year four, and then 100% in year five, if I recall. So how is Tesla Shanghai going to repay that loan? Well, I think they have to be profitable, right? If their expenses exceed their revenues, then they can't even repay the loan. I anticipate there will be some profit. I anticipate. But, well, it's going to be a challenge now with coronavirus, actually. It's going to be a real challenge for them to even be profitable. But any profit they do make will have to go to repaying those loans.
It's spoken it's going for, to take, right, yeah.
It is spoken. It's committed. It's long gone. Worse, you know, that working line they have is only $315 million or so. And it expires in 1 year. You know, Elon Musk is going to have to come crawling on broken glass to the Chinese overlords, begging them for an extension and an increase in that line after 1 year. They have got him completely over a barrel, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that the idea of that money being spoken for before it even comes in, that's just so crucial to have that segmented reporting there, because I mean, that is extraordinarily material. I'm not familiar, obviously, with GAAP rules and exactly what the segmented and consolidation rules are. But I mean, that's extraordinarily material, because what's going to happen, in my opinion, based on what you just said, is we're going to get press releases saying, oh, we made 100,000 in Shanghai. Oh, we made 200,000 in Shanghai. Oh, we made 300,000 in Shanghai. And the stock's going to rally on those numbers. And people are going to have no clue that the money that comes in from that, they're not even going to have any access to, or, you know, the main parent entity isn't going to have access to. It's already spoken for. So as is happening in the U.S., we get delivery numbers, the stock rallies on that. Nobody looks at the tangible financials.
Well, you know, you will have you'll have this situation where it could be that Tesla shows, for example, three or four quarters straight of profit and continues to need capital raises to stay alive.
Right.
And at some point while that's happening, somebody's going to wake up and say, why is that? I mean, let me tell you what, I think they're awake. I think this article got read. I think people are focused on it now. Maybe. God, you hope so, right? And that brings us to the second article. We had people say, this was gratifying, by the way. This never happens to me at Seeking Alpha. But in the first article, I got comments. When I say I, it's the royal I owe so much to Max Out Mama. Her analysis led me along the path. She dug up a lot of the data for me, and she helped me write it. And it was this is a collaborative, purely collaborative effort.
Before you go on to two, though, can I ask you one more question about the first one? So that we got to move in order.
Sure.
You know, I read the first article, and I know where this discussion goes. But one of the things that you mentioned in the first article is this ability for China to kind of come in and usurp everything that's happening at Tesla Shanghai. There's some condition and some agreement that has an arbitrary kind of discretionary clause to it that essentially says something to the effect of, hey, if we don't like how things are going, we're going to come in and take the factory over and take the company too, or something like that. Can you just explain that? Because that, it reminded me so much of this like VIE nonsense that happens. Can you just unpack that for the listeners a little bit so they're aware of what that risk might be?
Yeah. This is in the so-called grant contract, which the land, that there's a 214-acre factory site that is owned by the People's Republic of China. And they granted Tesla Shanghai the right to use that land and to build a factory on it for 50 years. But the grant comes with lots of conditions. And among other things, it says two things. It says if there are what it calls, and by the way, we don't have the agreements in the original Mandarin, which is what governs. All we have are translations. So it would really be good to have somebody who knows Mandarin very well take a look at the original Mandarin and advise on exactly what the nuances are here. And we don't have that. I'm surprised Tesla has not made these available. And honestly, it's disappointing considering their disclosure requirements that they haven't made them available. But in all events, the translation says that if special circumstances arise from the so-called public interest, then the Chinese government can revoke Tesla's grant early and simply, you know, repay it the residual value of the land. So you take the land and the improvements and they're all depreciated, and here's your even if you're making billions a year, we're just going to pay you for the land and improvements at their depreciated value. That's a huge stick to have over your head. The special circumstances are not defined. The public interest is not defined. It's whatever the Chinese want it to be. And there's another provision that says, you know, if there's this Shanghai Lingang Area Development and Construction Management Committee, who knows what they are, who knows who appoints them, who knows how it will be constituted, who knows what, if any, Tesla has on that. But anyway, if that, you know, Development and Construction Management Committee determines that, and this is from the English translation, the industry product within the granted lands fails to meet relevant standards, then again, the Chinese can just take the site back. They don't even have to compensate for that. So those are just enormous sticks over Tesla, and they exist even when the loan agreement is paid back. I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yep.
Yeah.
It's just something I thought would be worth fleshing out. Okay, so this whole first article left me with a taste in my mouth of, you know, look, Tesla does kind of risk becoming ultimately not only a Chinese entity, because if the production's coming from China and they're exporting from China, and that's, you know, all that production shifts from Fremont to China, and then you have all these kind of other outstanding things where now Elon appears to kind of be in the pocket of whoever's pulling the strings in China, it raises a lot of other interesting questions. You mentioned a second ago about, well, what's going to happen when some of these maturities come due for some of these loans, one of which I think is in December of this year. What do the terms look like for a refinancing? And then you bring up the points about, you know, what type of information Elon Musk has working for SpaceX. So why don't you lead us down that path, what you're getting at there?
Well, first of all, I mean, just in a fundamental business sense, the reason, among the reasons Tesla has lost money is that it is an inefficient manufacturer. It has, you know, more employees per car produced than any other auto manufacturer in the world, except for like a Ferrari or something, okay? And so Tesla started to improve its performance in 2019 as it had greater production out of Fremont and was able to spread out its so-called SG&A costs, okay, sales and general and administrative costs, and it became more efficient. Now what you're doing is you're saying to Tesla Fremont, it's great that you produced 360,000 cars, 368,000 cars last year, but we're going to take some of those away from you and move them to China. Now your utilization has dropped, your efficiency has dropped, and Tesla Shanghai is going to start exporting cars. And that means markets you potentially could have had or that you now have, you will no longer have.
Right.
And now your utilization factor is going to be hurt even worse. And this, Chris, is at a time when it is obvious that Tesla's demand in Europe is shrinking. I'm telling you, the Tesla logs are simply blind to the way in which Tesla is being eaten alive this year by very compelling EV offerings in Europe. Those offerings were held back last year because A, the cars weren't ready, or B, especially because the incentives under the European Union emissions regulatory scheme incentivized all the other producers to hold back until this year, because they get every EV they sell this year means they can sell another internal combustion car that's profitable. So that it makes sense for them to lose a lot of money on an EV just to be able to sell their profitable cars. And right. That's what happened. This year you have a flood of competition in Europe. So Tesla already faced a shrinking market in Europe. It faces a shrinking market in the U.S. with no more tax credit to subsidize these purchases. And with, you know, how deep is – there is a huge Tesla fan base, but it's only so big. It's huge. It's big, but it ain't infinite. And there's an exhaustion of demand that's happened to them in the U.S. Their order rate has dried up. On top of that, you had the coronavirus crisis. And it's a catastrophe for Fremont. And if Fremont now won't be able to extract any cash from China, assuming there were any left over, and it has to send $700 million to China, some of which it may have already sent, but it's got to – China doesn't have to fund the last 10% of its factory loan until Tesla has fully funded its $700 million. You've got just – you're hemorrhaging cash, and you won't be able to touch it for 5 years – if it's profitable, and you're in a world of hurt where the worldwide auto market is collapsing, it's a terrible position to be in. I kind of got off the track. I think you asked me about the second article, but
yeah, that's how I. That's okay though. That's good. And I was just gonna say on that aside, you know, the demand though has never mattered. Like you say, oh well, the longs have been missing this. You know, they've been missing it about 5 years, you know?
Chris, I'm not here to talk about how the share price is going to reflect this. I hope you know that. Who the hell knows if and when the share price will ever have one thing to do with reality?
Right.
I mean, I think but I'm just saying, if you're long Tesla right now, your thesis has to be that the share price will never, ever reflect reality, that you can see the company shrink in terms of profits and revenues, revenues. You can see the losses magnify. You can see the disastrous deal that Elon Musk made in China become apparent to all the world, and still no one will ever care. If that's your thesis, I mean, load up on stock, okay?
I read that in a Buffett book somewhere, I think.
You asked about SpaceX and
China's leverage. You know, let's talk about China's leverage.
You know, I know many Chinese people, Chinese Americans. I don't put any of this on the Chinese people, but they live under a very autocratic government with enormous control that is enhanced by, you know, the technology we have today, which enables them to monitor the communications and the activities of every citizen in China and to give them a social credit score. And, you know, if you cross the government, look what happened to the researchers and doctors who were honest about this virus in China. They disappeared. Okay. Look what happened to the journalists who reported honestly on it. They were expelled. This is a totalitarian state, and anybody who has any illusions about that, it's unforgivable to me to close your eyes to that. Now, last year, Musk famously went to this artificial intelligence conference they held, and the Chinese made a huge deal of it, right, Lording it over the United States, saying, "Look, you're this great genius, visionary, healer of the world, savior of society. Elon Musk has come here to the Chinese, and he has said China is the future." That's a quote from Elon Musk. China is the future. So take that, you running dog imperialists. And, you know, that's a serious thing. I think he has to do what they want him to do now. They own him, okay? He may think he's independent. I'm not saying I don't know what the hell goes through his mind. I broke my own rule there, didn't I? But
yeah, that's the second time actually you said hell.
Just is it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we...
I wasn't going to say anything.
We of the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church do believe it in a heaven and a hell.
Well, listen, he might not, like you said. First off, the Chinese are so shrewd and so smart and so ruthless when it comes to really everything. Oh, the people in
so
power,
is Musk.
But he's also a dope. He's also
He's a narcissist.
Oblivious.
He's a narcissist. Narcissists are easy to fool like that. Hey, and you know, I think he got taken to the cleaners in this deal. And you know, let me ask you this. It has struck me as more than coincidental. Maybe I'm wrong. That just as the United States begins to get ready to implement its ban on travel from China because of this COVID virus, simultaneously, Musk tweets that the coronavirus is no more, quote, virulent than, you know, I think he finally likened it to a common cold. And that was on January 31st.
Wow.
You know, to what extent, if any, did the Chinese communicate to him that they wanted him to push back on the political effort? And remember, there were lots of people who then criticized Trump, by the way. If you think I'm ready to support Trump or praise Trump or get behind him, no, by no means. But I'm saying that move, the worst you can say about that move was that it was too little and too late. And there were people who criticized it. The Chinese certainly criticized it. Why did Trump do that? And then he kept it up for a month and a half with all those criticisms of the overreaction and the panic to the coronavirus and the fact that children, you know, were immune and utter nonsense. And until he finally decided to do a 180 and become the savior of humanity with his sleep apnea ventilators.
There's no doubt in my mind that he uses Twitter as a blow-off valve sometimes when things aren't going his way or he doesn't, you know, I forget what it was, but Charlie Grant had posted something this morning about the D&O insurance and somebody had sent me a message or I can't remember where the hell I read it, but somebody had said, oh, this explains Musk's tweet a couple of days ago, you know, ostensibly insinuating, I don't know whether it's correct or not, that Musk put out some tweet after, you know, he determined that he couldn't get D&O insurance. I don't know whether or not that happened. But I know that I feel like things that I've read from him on Twitter in the past have been him kind of lashing out if he doesn't get his way. And there's no doubt in my mind that when he tweeted the coronavirus panic is dumb, that the thing driving his decision making and putting that tweet out was whether or not it was going to have an impact on Tesla one way or another, whether it was having to shut down Fremont, whether it was bowing to pressure from the Chinese, no doubt in my mind.
Okay, well, I just poured myself a little more wine. Let me get you back on focus, Chris. You know, you sometimes go off on tangents. Let's get back to this Chinese story and the people who push back, okay? Just, I'm only kidding you, of course.
Oh, I was going to say, you brought it up. What the hell?
Well, I was making a point, and then you interrupted me and made it the main theme. No, you asked about the pushback, the second article, which, you know, as I said, what was gratifying was that there were some Tesla longs who said, holy crow, thank you for this. Thank you. You have, you and Maxed Out Mama have called to my attention things I had never considered, things I had never even thought about, and it is concerning. So there were people who read this article and had that reaction, and that never happens. Okay, usually the quality of the comments is distressing, right? So this was really gratifying to see so many thoughtful comments, and a lot of these people who are genuinely Tesla enthusiasts said, what about this argument? And what about this argument? And what about this argument? Trying to say that we're wrong, that maybe we've made a mistake. And so we took a careful look at what we thought were the legitimate good arguments that people made. And they were really very good arguments. And we went through them one by one. We picked out the best five and went through them one by one in the second article. And one argument was, okay, you know, it looks like you're right. It looks like Tesla can't get any money out of China as long as it owes money to China. How about Tesla goes ahead and raises money right now to pay off all the debt it owes to China? And that doesn't solve the problem of, you know, special circumstances and public interest and not meeting the relevant standards, etc. But it does allow you to get the money out, right?
Right.
So here's some problems with that. Number one, who knows what Tesla's cash situation is today? Now, I predict it will finish Q1, which was, you know, a month ago, with a higher cash balance or close to the same cash balance that it had at the end of the year, because it raised $2.3 billion in the first quarter. It sure as hell, sure as heck better do that, right, Chris? But come on now, hell is allowed.
You went there first, man. That's all I'm saying.
So
you predict that it'll finish Q1 with the same
I think the cash situation since March is a balance sheet unwind, where you have no money coming in virtually, but you have this huge accounts receivable and accrued liability balance that has to be dealt with. You ordered parts for 500,000 cars this year. Well, you'll try to squeeze your vendors, no doubt, but you're going to squeeze them out of business if you don't pay some of them. You know, Tesla is going to have to be paying out cash because its balance sheet was so unbalanced. The accounts receivable part of it was far outweighed by the accounts payable and the accrued liability part. You know, cash plus accounts receivable didn't come close to the other two. So there's a balance sheet unwind going on every week right now, and it's, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, millions, that was not billions. You're going to have a massive cash burn right now. And Tesla has some big cash needs. We already know it has to spend $700 million in China. How much did it spend last year? Well, maybe some of that, but let's say it's only got half of that left. That's $350 million it needs to send to China. The cash it has in China ain't moving out, that's for sure. And now it's talking, you know, it signed a contract that I don't know that it's paid yet in Brandenburg for this German factory, right? With the European auto market vastly oversupplied already, Tesla announces it's going to build a capital in Brandenburg. The Brandenburg political officials showing they're every bit as stupid as the officials in California and Nevada and New York, just can't wait to offer subsidies for them. And Tesla says, we're in a big hurry, and we got to knock down this forest before we get our final permit. The Germans say, go ahead and do it. Of course, you know, it's at risk. It's your risk if you don't get the permit. And so Tesla knocks down the forest. And now suddenly things have ground to a halt. It'll be interesting. But you know, if Tesla goes forward with that factory, which is crucial to its growth narrative, okay, even though it's an idiotic thing to do, it will cost billions. It's going to be much more expensive to build a factory in China, in Germany. The Germans, unlike the Chinese, are not going to just wave away any environmental and safety concerns. Right. They're going to require it to be done. It's probably as bad or worse than California, okay? And that's going to cost a lot of money, even with subsidies, because the subsidies are not going to be paid up front, I don't think. Maybe as you go along, you'll get some, and maybe when you sell cars, you'll get more. But so you have that. So where does Tesla come up with the money?
Didn't they protest them, too, when they came in to make the space to build the factory in Germany? Like you said, they cut down a whole forest, and then there were like all these environmental protesters that showed up.
Well, what I loved is all the Tesla cultists immediately switch to, you know, Elon's going to save the earth, but that forest is not important. It was just for pulp and paper. And by the way, we need to hoard as much toilet paper as we can, but that forest isn't important. Right. I mean, how do you live a life like these people do and keep your head straight? I don't know. Anyway, that's a huge capital commitment you have there. Right. And you're burning cash ferociously right now with this factory shutdown. You have an economic collapse where you are going to face really weakened demand. You already are challenged in your European market with ferocious competition. Where do you come up with the extra cash where you can now afford to go pay off this Chinese loan, which was on such favorable terms? I don't get it. Anyway, you can do Brandenburg or you can do Shanghai, but you can't do both. And if you don't do Brandenburg, you've just harshed your growth narrative. So that was one of the arguments, and that's essentially our response to it. And there were other arguments. Fremont alone will have enough demand. It's just, you know, we took a good close look at all the demand statistics. There's no way Fremont has enough demand. That was evident in Q1 already. And it's going to be ferociously evident now. And then, well, China can soak it up. Well, we demonstrated, I think, really carefully that maybe China can take 100,000 cars, maybe in a good year, 150. But it can't take more than that. You're going to have to be exporting. And moreover, the structure of the agreements contemplates that you'll be exporting cars, contemplates that the Chinese will be boasting about their made in China and, as they like to say, designed in China Tesla cars that they are exporting to foreign markets to show the, you know, that they are the world leaders in design and manufacture. It's going to happen, and you're going to cut further into the Fremont demand. Then there are people who said, well, you know, Tesla can just forbid this from happening. Well, how are you going to forbid it from happening if you've already agreed it can happen? That, you know, your agreement contemplates that they can export. Of course they're going to export. You know, people are just looking for some way out of this horrible situation. They simply can't conceive that Elon Musk could have made such a terrible deal. You know, the guy that they consider this great genius, how could he have been out-negotiated like this? I mean, what, you know, maybe he thought the world would look different right now. He certainly didn't count on coronavirus. No one did. But, and then there were a couple other arguments. Well, you know, China doesn't have enough talent to manufacture cars that anybody would want for export. Well, look at the really crappy quality of the Model Ys we're seeing. I'll bet you China can do better. You know, maybe they have enough talent, maybe they don't, but they certainly are counting on having the talent, and they're certainly counting on manufacturing them. You know, that's like saying, well, they're going to fail in their goal. Well, maybe they fail in their goal. How does that help Tesla? And then another argument was, well, you know, Tesla could just brick all the cars. If China gets nasty, we'll just leave China. We'll brick all our cars that are there. And we will have the exclusive right to our logo and brand. Uh-huh. And we showed how in the agreements, it's very likely Tesla has already pledged its logo and its brand and its IP, intellectual property, as collateral. There aren't many escape routes the Chinese have left Tesla. And if Tesla wants to go fight about it in court, guess where that court is? You know, it's in the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, good luck with that one.
Rot's a ruck. You know, it's... Elon Musk has snookered so many people and taken so many people to the cleaners that people are having a hard time believing it could have happened to him here. But it has. I think it has. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe somebody will come up with some cogent argument about why it hasn't. Maybe in this conference call somebody will ask Musk, is it true that Tesla Shanghai will have the right to export cars? And maybe he'll say, no, absolutely not. It won't happen. That would be interesting. So I'd like to, we'll see where all that goes.
Well, when you mentioned before that how much traction the article had gotten in, you said you were hopeful that it had really struck a nerve. That was the first thing I thought of, was if you start to hear questions about this on the conference call, you'll know that it really struck a nerve and it really got a good reception, because there are obviously now crucial unanswered questions that he needs to be asked so that he can lie about the answers on a conference call.
Well, you know, the conference calls are...
they're fun.
They start with a big, long filibuster, and then you get people called on who are certain to ask comfy questions. And if anything that ever comes close to touching a nerve is asked, it's evaded quickly. And they've become increasingly useless and increasingly embarrassing if you're a serious investor. I don't look for anything good.
Let me ask you a question. When you look at the share price, and I know, you know, your analysis is on the facts and you're not really trying to predict where the share price is going and why it's moving in any such direction, which I think is a fruitless effort for the most part. But something that has just nagged me is the mechanics of how the share price moves. I don't know. There's just something about it to me that just doesn't feel necessarily right. My question is, and I'm not asking for you to speculate on anything, my question is, do you think about things like his compensation package, which requires, you know, $100 billion market cap? You think about those things in relation to the share price?
I don't know. It's easy to become conspiratorial because the price is just so outrageously detached from fundamentals, and because the level it's reached appears to be conveniently close to what he needs to achieve his next compensation award. I mean, as I tell the people who read my articles right now, you know, stay away from this. There are forces larger than us moving this share price.
Right.
And that's all I'll say. There are forces larger than us. Do I fully understand them? No. Might it be Chinese money? Sure. Might it be offshore accounts of some sort? Possible. Might there be some unseemly things going on? It's always a possibility, too. Regardless, my innocent assumption is that there are a lot of people out there, including, you know, big institutional investors who still either believe in the growth story or believe that it hasn't ended yet and it makes sense to ride this thing with a momentum trade. And that's what we have to deal with. We have to deal with the reality we have.
Right. And I understand we have to stick to the facts. And I just, you know, I can't, and I try not to even think about Tesla that much, but I can't ignore the fact that I've watched tape and I've watched trading every day for the last probably 10 years. And I just have noticed on the last two big moves in Tesla, the one that drove it from 400 to 1,000 or 400 to 960, and then this last one now here from 520 up to 799, I think it hit here recently. There was call buying that came in prior to those moves. And it's not unusual to see call buying come in and then a stock react as soon as that happens, or call buying come in before a share price move or before material news. But there wasn't any material news. It was just... It was as if somebody was lighting a fuse by buying calls, and then the share price was reacting in the subsequent days or weeks. And I just, for some reason, I'm sure there's probably a reasonable explanation for it, but that's the last time I'm going to mention it. I can't shake it from my brain for some reason. Something about it just doesn't feel right to me. But I could be wrong. I'm wrong often, and this is not financial advice. So
yeah, right. Well, that's from me either. Though, I've read these theories about this, you know, convexity and people buying calls to force the people who have to hedge to buy stock, and who knows? I mean, one thing I am convinced of after looking at that amended 10K today is that Tesla's getting ready to do another capital raise. Its cash position is worse than it has let on. Of course, it will only need to reveal the March 31 number on when it gives its financial results.
Right.
Hopefully somebody will say, what is your cash position today? But they'll evade that question. And I think you're seeing this amended 10K now with the earnings coming out tomorrow because they are going to quickly move to raise capital again. And it'll be interesting to see where all that goes. So,
the gentleman that was just brought on the board that we were talking about, who hates short sellers and worked for the Japanese pension funds, etc. One of the things in his biography I read somewhere, I don't know where I read it, but was that he had essentially prevented shares in a. He had a $400 million portfolio and had prevented all the shares from being lent out. You know, he had pulled the borrow on shares. And that just stuck out at me too, man. These things, they just kind of like that. I don't know. Anyways, let's move on before we start diving into things that we don't have any evidence for or facts for. The last thing I heard of yours was a great podcast that you did. I think it was TC's podcast, and you actually dove into macro a little bit, which I thought was very interesting because it was something we had never talked about and obviously something I'm very passionate about. And I wanted to see if you would just kind of spend a couple of minutes telling my listeners what you make of the macroeconomic situation right now. We have an economy that's shut down, and we have a Fed that's trying to paper it over. What does Montana Skeptic think?
Well, in great truth, he doesn't know what to think, okay? We're in a place we've never been ever in the economic history of any country on earth, I think.
Right.
There's never been ever this kind of massive federal bank intervention that we're seeing right now. And, you know, we're about to run a deficit this year, probably close to $3.5 to $4 trillion,
right,
which is close to 20% of our GDP. And the way GDP is going, maybe it'll be more than that. So, and we're running a stimulus program where we're just throwing money at problems with legislation that's tossed together before anybody knows what's in it, and where it's at least it's inevitable that some of the money's going to go to places that you really didn't wish it would go, and that much of the money won't get to places where it really needs to go. So, and we're in the, this is the first time in my life, at least, where we have voluntarily shut down an economy. It's not some external, you know, it's not that financial conditions forced it. It's the government said we have got to shut down our economy to protect everyone's public health. And of course, that's controversial as well. And I have absolutely no expertise to be opining about that. You know, I read passionate arguments on both sides of the debate about whether we overreacted, et cetera. And I see some people who make compelling cases that this is more serious even than we imagine, and others who make the case that we're overreacting. And you know, honestly, there's good faith on both sides, and there's some, you know, really absurd partisanship on both sides. But in terms of the macro, what I did is, you and I both, I think, are familiar with the work of Grant Williams, who I regard as a just Renaissance man of our times. And he did an interview during this coronavirus time with a woman named Stephanie Pomboy. And the two of them have communicated over the years. And they had some theories about the world that were, to me, fascinating. And I wanted to write about it because it's much bigger than Tesla. And it's much more important than Tesla. And, you know, I thought, let me for once try to address what they think. And, you know, they are coming from a place where they have been very suspicious of central bank activity with the quantitative easing projects, because they believe that all this monetary policy we've seen since the great financial crisis of 2008 has repressed interest rates. And so you no longer know what the most important price in the market is, which is, you know, how much, what is the price of risk? What is the real interest rate?
Right.
It's been artificially reduced. And so with that happening, what happens is that the historic spread between very risky debt or junk bonds and investment grade debt has shrunken. It's compressed to a historic low, so that now, with investors unable to achieve enough of a yield in the bond market, they have been forced to, you know, go into either buy risky debt or to buy equities, okay, which is that effect that's called TINA, for there is no alternative. And that has led to an enormous inflation in financial assets. You see equity markets charging upwards, right? And it's kind of feeds on itself. The low interest rates have encouraged corporations to borrow money and use the money to buy back their own stock, which has become controversial in these bailouts, right? And that in turn adds fuel to the fire, causing their stock prices to rise. And of course, all the leverage puts them now, when you have a downturn, they're all very vulnerable. They have debt they cannot service. And meanwhile, you know, even though we've had this 10-year bull market, the United States government and governments around the world have continued to run massive deficits, right, and pile on more debt. And state and local governments, certainly here in the U.S., have said, wow, look how low interest rates are. Let's go ahead and issue more munis. And so monetary policy has encouraged a lot of leverage at state and local governments. And despite that, the problem that really needed to be addressed hasn't been addressed. We had 10 years ago an obvious public and private pension market crisis coming. It was clear that there were unfunded liabilities that were more acute in certain states and localities than in others, but certainly like in Illinois and New Jersey and New York. People have seen this coming for years. I'm telling you, Chris, when I started work in New York in 2011, I read really cogent pieces about this coming pension crisis. There was a guy at J.P. Morgan named Michael Sembalest, C-E-M-B-A-L-E-S-T, who wrote some truly brilliant pieces under the name of The Ark and the Covenant, ARC being ARC for Annual Required Contribution, and outlining all the dangers we were sailing into here. And despite the bull market, states and municipalities did not contribute enough to get rid of those unfunded liabilities. And the pension funds, meanwhile, are looking for investments that they can make, and they used to go buy, you know, investment grade debt, and that would be plenty enough to satisfy their return requirement every year. Well, as that debt got beaten down in interest rates, okay, lower and lower, that wasn't enough. So they had to take on riskier investments. They started investing in private equity. They started investing in hedge funds. They started investing in junk bonds, all sorts of things that are very collateralized loan obligations, you know, leveraged loans. So now that this coronavirus has hit, it's a catastrophe. It's a catastrophe. Their portfolios are in desperate shape. It is beyond question that, for example, the state of Illinois and the state of New Jersey will be first in line. They're as every much as a basket case as Puerto Rico was, okay? And you're going to have states now trying to get in line at the trough and feed from the trough of all this money coming from the federal government, so they can bail out their pension obligations. And so anyway, that's what Pomboy and Grant Williams were discussing. And they saw, I can keep going, or you can, you know, if I'm just carrying on too much.
Well, no, I think I'd be interested in your thoughts on it. I mean, obviously, there's a couple of different arguments you could make, right? You could say, I mean, so you're completely right about everything. Pension funds have been trying to do this carry trade over the last couple of years.
That's their view of the backdrop, and yes, I agree with that. Right, where they go from here is, you know, debatable, but I absolutely agree with all the things I just outlined.
You know, one of the things that I've thought of over the last couple of days, which is this is very unlike me because, you know, I'm from the Austrian school. I could say. But I kept thinking, like, well, if they're going to print all this money and they say there's going to be no consequence to it, why don't they just bail out the entire country? They're just, you know, we're already committed to printing $8 trillion, $10 trillion, $12 trillion, whatever it is. You know, why don't we just bail out the whole country? I mean, while we're doing that. Yeah. I mean, obviously there would be inflationary problems with that. And as soon as everybody got a clean slate, we would go back and drive our country back into financial ruin because that's how we understand finance incorrectly. That's how we understand money management incorrectly. I mean, what are your thoughts on the massive amount of money that we're printing?
Well, you know, that's where you get this disconnect, because the people, there are a lot of really, really bright people who say, look, we haven't had any inflation yet, despite people like, hey, come on, let's be fair, Grant Williams and Stephanie Palm, well, Grant more than Stephanie, worrying that we would have inflation. Okay, interest rates haven't gone up, though Pomboy said they wouldn't go up, and had good reasons for that. So there's no reason to think we're going to have any hyperinflation down the road. By the way, what Pomboy and Williams see is first a terrible deflationary period, followed by hyperinflation. And so when you say to these people, okay, well, we're going to have a $3.5 trillion deficit this year. How about we just bail out everybody? We pay off all the student loans. We give the corporations enough money to pay off all their debt. Everybody emerges from this whole thing debt-free except the United States government. Why don't we just do that? Are there no limits? Well, clearly there are limits, okay? And nobody has been able to persuade me where they are. I'm not smart right. enough to tell you where they are. Right. But here's what Pomboy and Williams think. They think that this crisis we're in is going to lead to behavioral change in the U.S., that households and corporations are going to realize that having all this debt is catastrophic, and they're going to try and cut back on it. They're going to become more parsimonious, and the only person spending is going to be the United States government, and the only person lending is going to be the Federal Reserve. Okay, and so you're going to see, we're seeing these enormous deficits. We have this pension crisis, which is upon us. Okay, and so far in history, what has saved us is that other countries were willing to buy our debt.
Right.
And what Pomboy and Williams think, and I don't, you know, I'm not saying they're right or they're wrong. I just thought it was a fascinating discussion, and I wanted to recount it so people started thinking about it. They say, look, what the world has been doing is, in effect, vendor financing. They have been saying, we will sell you stuff, and you know, we're selling it to you, so we'll buy your debt so you can pay us for it. And as long as we're selling you lots of stuff, that makes sense. But what happens when they decide that A, we decide we're not going to buy from the Chinese as much anymore, or we don't buy as much anymore because our economy is shrinking. Well, they're not going to be so eager to vendor finance anymore. And what happens when they look at the massive deficits we're running up? They might start to worry about the strength of the United States dollar. They might start to worry about the likelihood of them being repaid. And the temptation for the United States government, they have to worry about that. The United States government has got so much debt that it, if it keeps up much longer, and I mean like another month or two, we're going to have so much debt that the only way to repay that debt is going to be to so-called monetize it, to have massive inflation so that you pay it back in dollars that are worth much less than the dollars that you borrowed it in. That's, historically what's we've seen happen. So I wrote about that. And of course, where they finally got to was gold, right? They thought they had interesting theories about gold. And I'm no gold bug, but I did make the case that people, in light of all this, should what gold used to do. It used to be a discipline for a currency. If you tied your currency to gold, you couldn't issue unlimited amounts of it. And you assured that it would have value and that you had some guard against hyperinflation. Okay, there was by no means a perfect system. Would we ever return to a gold standard of some type? I don't know. They think that might happen. Would we ever, because we have large gold reserves here, maybe that's a way out for us. Maybe we say we're broke and the new US dollar will be tethered by gold. Sorry about all the money we owe you, or something like that. But I was making the case that investors should consider having some gold exposure in their portfolio. And I laid out the different ways, some of the different ways you can invest in gold. There are a lot of them. And so that was what that was all about.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, as I'm sure you probably know, with regard to gold, and whether or not we wind up.
Wait, 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 wait. I was putting that. I'm not saying I'm advocating it. I don't know, and I'm not 100% certain, okay? But I wanted people to think about it, right? So I don't want to be seen as saying go buy gold, but I do want to be seen as saying read these arguments, take them seriously, and consider whether you shouldn't have some in your portfolio. And consider even the crazy radical idea, disparaged by the modern monetary theorists, that maybe the gold standard, what for all its faults, had some virtues too that we may come to appreciate.
Yeah, of course it had virtues. I mean, it was there to prevent exactly what's going on now, right? I know that you're not advocating for it, you're not telling people to go do it, and I'm not doing the same thing. But to me, I don't know, that just makes sense. There's this argument over whether we will default or whether we will try to print our way out of our problem. I think both of those situations, when you said that they say we're going to have this deflationary period, they are arguing that that's going to be a result of what? Just lack of demand?
Say that again. When they say we're going to default, they
No,
say
when
that
they
the
say we're going
world
to
is
have
going
a
to have less of.
deflation, you said that they were arguing that we're going to go through a deflationary period.
Well, I mean, I think we're about to see that happen now. You're going to have automobile companies that can't sell their autos. They're cutting prices. They're offering amazing incentives. Airlines that can't sell seats, they're going to be cutting prices. Obviously, oil companies that can't sell gas, they're cutting prices. There's going to be some real deflationary pressures, or certainly when it comes to luxury goods and a lot of hard, manufactured goods as well. So yeah, I think
Temporarily.
temporarily, right? Temporarily, because the government is going to have to pay back this debt. And I'm afraid the only way to do it is to have just a ferocious inflation.
Yeah.
But I listen, I'm not a macroeconomist. I don't have a degree in economics. There are
Well, that's the best
endless
thing about you.
people that there are endless people far more sophisticated in all this stuff than I am. I'm interested in it. I was glad to write about it, and I hope to keep writing about it. But learning from people who have carefully thought out views about it, whether they're right or wrong, they're worth considering. That's the way I look at it.
Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for taking an hour out of your day today. I know it was difficult to get a hold of you and find a time that worked for both of us. So I appreciate you making it happen, and I know that my listeners do. And I'd like to tell you that if you ever want to come on and just try to talk macro, I'd love to do that whenever you inevitably arrive at the conclusion that gold is the way to go.
Okay. Well, you stick with Peter Schiff for now, and let me keep working at it.
All right.
But listen, Chris, I'm sorry we haven't gotten together more, but this was fun to do, and I feel like we really covered a lot of ground tonight, and I thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, and we'll speak soon, all right?
Okay, mighty
good. All right, bye-bye. That was the one, the only Montana skeptic. I'm happy he came back on, and I made it through a whole podcast without cursing. How about that? Can you believe it? He's making me into a better man. Thank you so much, sir. Tomorrow I go back to being a degenerate. Fools! See you then. I'm out for now. Peace.